Willie Trotty is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Trotty to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Pat Hartwell, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special guest, federal public defender Dale Bache, who continues to speak out against the recent two-hour execution of client Joseph Wood. The execution watch for Willie Trotty begins.
And good evening. This is Ray Hill of Execution Watch. Our producer, Elizabeth Stein, has got today's program set up. We have not missed you folks during the long period of time that we have not been executing in Texas. It was kind of a sabbatical that we on Execution Watch look forward to enjoying because we do this show because we feel there's a journalistic responsibility to do this show and not because we enjoy doing it. And as the host of this program since its inception, I want to express my deep appreciation to the lawyers who cooperate with us here. I want to say hello to the guys down on death row who can actually hear tonight's show because we're on broadcast. And I can report to those folks who have friends and loved ones in Huntsville that I talked to the engineer just before coming up here. We will be rebroadcasting the Huntsville area translator in just a few weeks. So we've got the license. We've found the tower. They're doing the mechanical things, and Steve says we'll have sound soon. That voice that comes on with the billboard as the beginning of the thing is that wonderful voice that is Larry Douglas's voice. It's a treasure in radio to have that. He comes with his wisdom, but we also have the wizard. Jim Skelton, what happened in this case?
Well, Willie Trotty back in 1990, I guess back in 1992, had been married to a woman.
Hold on just a second. I've got to bring Pat up. Pat, are you there?
Yes, I am, Ray.
What's going on there?
Well, we have about 35 people here, 15 or 17 of his family members. T-Rock has a very large, supportive family. Of course, I want to say hi to everybody on the row. I want to extend our sympathies, especially to Cupcake and Rudy, who were very good friends of T-Rock. We're just waiting. The witnesses have already gone across,
okay.
And now we're just waiting. I understand from Elizabeth that you want to talk to Michael Trotty, who is the brother of T-Rock.
If you have him handy there.
I do. He's right here.
This is Ray.
How you doing, sir?
I am well, Michael. I'm sorry that you and your family are going through this.
I'm strong today. You know, today is the day because, you know, I know my brother going to a better place.
Okay, I do know that there are British Broadcasting Corporation media people there.
Yes.
So please take time to talk to them and tell them the story of Texas' propensity to kill people.
Yes.
And thank you for joining the prison show.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
All right.
Now, Jim, what's going on?
As I explained earlier, a gentleman by the name of Willie Trotty was involved with a woman by the name of Barbara Canada. They lived together, had a child together. And back in 1992, they separated. And thereafter, they had a very tumultuous relationship. He did such things as kidnap her, apparently had a lot of problems with her leaving him, threatened to kill her if she didn't come back to him, even bumped her car one time on a freeway or highway. And what he did, he gave her a deadline to come back to him by May the 1st or he's going to kill her. And what happened, the deadline passed, she didn't come back. So on May the 3rd, He goes to Barbara Canada's house. Inside the house is her mother, some small children, plus her brother. It's 11 o'clock at night. He kicks in the door armed with a 9mm pistol. When he breaks open the door, the brother of Barbara shoots at him and hits him, and he shoots back and hits the brother. He's wounded at this point, and what that does at this point, he's wounded, but he still goes to the back bedroom. He corners Barbara Canada, shoots her 11 times, and during the times he shoots her, he says, "I told you I was going to kill you, you bitch," is what he said to her.
Don't you have to reload the 9mm?
Well, apparently he had clips. I was imagining he had clips, obviously, because he shot her 11 times. Plus, he had already shot earlier at the brother and wounded him. And then at that point, he shoots Barbara's mother, doesn't kill her. She's one of Barbara's younger juvenile sisters, does not kill him. And at this point, the brother, Titus, who had shot him when he first entered the house, was apparently in the bedroom laying face down on the floor. He shoots him twice in the back of the head. And then he leaves the location at that point, goes to a hospital to get medical care, and that's where he's arrested when they go to get medical care. And in this case, it's very no doubt about guilt or innocence issue in this entire trial is punishment, because obviously everybody in the house knew him and identify him. He had two dead people, plus he's arrested shortly thereafter at the hospital getting medical care.
So treating his own wounds.
That's right. So there never was a question about guilt or innocence. The whole issue boiled down to what happened to punishment.
Who's handling Susan?
Okay. At the punishment phase of the trial, the state puts on some of his prior convictions. He had a 1988 conviction for theft in Louisiana. Apparently it was a misdemeanor, it was very small theft. In 1990, he had a conviction for unauthorized carrying a weapon. That was in Texas. And in 1990, he had a felony theft case that he was given a deferred adjudication probation. And I guess the probation period was supposed to be 5 years. Right as soon as Barbara left him, he started essentially harassing her, stalking her, calling her, threatening her. In 1992, he shot, in October of 92, he shot the tires out, her tires out of her car. And later she took out a protective order. And in March 1993, he hit her car. Apparently he was pursuing her. He hit her car, I guess got her off the highway, and he kidnapped her for a while and got her, I guess out of fear, to promise to come back to him before he let her go. Now,
how old was this person while all this was going on?
I think he was in his late 20s.
Okay. Okay.
The defense was 28 years old.
28 years old.
And Barbara's about the same age, right?
28 years old, so he would have been pretty close to that when he was doing all the kidnapping.
Exactly.
Hitting the car.
28
years old.
Although
that happened over a short period of time.
About a year period of time prior to this.
Now, the defense put on evidence through people who had worked with him or had worked for him that apparently he worked with a group of young professionals of Houston program.
Mm-hmm.
And he also worked as a security guard, but there were people who worked for him or knew him that said he did good work for the organization and he was a good worker and said, I guess, good things about him. His mother and his sister also testified. The basic idea with the mother and sister was the mother apparently had dropped him off with other children, his other siblings, at a hotel room. The idea was to drop him off at a hotel room that supposedly his father was staying there.
How old was he? 11 years old? How old was he at the time?
I think he was 10 years old.
So she,
yeah, 9 years old.
She dumped him when he was 10 years
right.
old.
Okay. He was nine years old. He was the oldest of the four children. Mm-hmm. Okay, then apparently the children went off to his store because they were hungry. People gave him some food. They later called the police, and the children were put into foster care. And so he was at various different foster care homes, and he tried to run away and find his mother. And then basically they...
All of this was presented at the punishment hearing?
Yes.
Or are all these just facts that could have been presented?
No, there was a... doctor who testified, Dr. Priscilla Ray, testified that he needed therapy and medication for depression, and he had issues with abandonment. And she linked his childhood experience with his mother abandoning him with his reaction to Barbara leaving him. That was basically the psychiatrist's
testimony. And to answer your question, Connie Williams defended him. Connie's been around the courthouse a long time. And so what Connie basically did, he knew it was going to be a punishment issue, and that's why he put family members on showing he's abandoned. Then he called us a professional to try to explain how this worked and how he's had trouble being abandoned by his girlfriend.
He was trying to build up a case for mitigating circumstances.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that just didn't work.
Didn't float.
Well, I think he was working with, I believe, the only thing he had to work with.
Sure, sure.
Okay, and it's just that the actual crime itself was so deliberate.
If you were handling this case, would you have done anything different?
I don't think you could have done anything different. I mean, the actual, you know, crime itself, that he said she had to come back to him or he would kill her, and he did.
Yeah.
And there wasn't any heat of passion. It was planned.
It was like biblical prophecy, I told you, and
yeah,
I did it.
It's like that line in the country song, they laughed at me and then I shot them.
Right. Do we have someone holding on to be on there? Is this our interview or is this one of the Milton? We were supposed to get a report from the Texas Vigil from Dave Atwood, but we haven't heard from him.
I mean, basically, the Dr. Priscilla Ray's testimony was not enough to overcome, shall we say, the jury's opinion that he would be a future threat to society.
So they didn't spend any time on guilt or innocence. They went straight to trying to build up a predicate for punishment that might have saved his life.
That's a larger call, because if you know you're going to be found guilty, you know eventually you're going to face the jury for punishment. Really, the only issue in this case was punishment. There's no way in the world he wouldn't have been found guilty of this.
Okay. What happened to the appeal to this case?
I think Larry's going to talk about some of the stuff they discussed on different appellate issues. One of the, they're going to talk about the ineffectiveness on not claiming self-defense, right, Larry?
Yes. First of all, there was a claim of ineffective assistance for counsel, claiming that the trial counsel's representation was deficient, and but for the deficiency, the result would have been different. Specifically on self-defense, apparently what Mr. Williams is trying to do is work on, as I said earlier, punishment. And so the punishment would have been, well, depending upon what he was found guilty of. If there was any sort of way to convince the jury that he was found, to find him guilty of murder or manslaughter, some lesser included, that's what Connie seemed to be working, laying the groundwork for. That seemed to be his defensive strategy. In terms of self-defense, it appears that the writ lawyers were claiming that the fact that the brother, Titus, shot at Trotty first.
Okay.
So if he shot at Trotty first, then should have been self-defense. Well, Connie used that. I mean, there was evidence that he shot at him first. Connie argued, yeah, he shot at him first, but in order to use the self-defense strategy, you've got to first not be involved in criminal activity yourself. He's breaking into somebody's house with a gun, trying to shoot them after having threatened them and after having had a protective order issued against him. So rather than losing his credibility with the jury, apparently Connie decided that's not what I wanted. That's not the way I'm going to handle it. He did get in the evidence that Titus shot at him first, but then after Titus shot at him, you know, he again was in the process of committing a criminal act, and even the killing was far after the shooting. Shooting Titus in the back of the head twice, shooting Miss Canada, who hadn't shot at him. Those are all sorts of things that apparently and really intelligently his lawyer chose not to try to use the defense of self-defense, and he probably would have just lost the jury. So he decided not to do it that way, but for whatever reason, the writ lawyers use that as a support for their claim of ineffective assistance of counsel.
Could those writ lawyers have done anything differently?
Well, writ lawyers write writs, okay, right. And they don't try the case, okay? So the writ lawyers, apparently the way that the writ lawyers seem to look at it is if there's anything that could save a man's life, regardless of whether you end up trashing the trial lawyer, they pretty much do it. So if he does not argue self-defense, then they say, well, the fact that you didn't argue self-defense is ineffective. They also claim that there were lots of witnesses that you could have called that you didn't. Well, the trial lawyer has to use his own trial strategy and decide to call the witnesses that he sees as being helpful to his case and not call witnesses whose testimony might be cumulative. Or the thing in trials is that everything seems to be, oftentimes evidence is a two-edged sword. So those things that that help you some might even hurt you worse. So the courts determined that the actions that Mr. Williams took, one, were not ineffective, and also were consistent with trial strategy. And even I think one of the courts even commended Mr. Williams for not bringing in the self-defense argument, because I think the jury would have killed him if he had chosen to do that.
Ray, and answer your question, basically what writ lawyers do is one of two things. They throw everything at the wall, whether it's logic or not, sure, hoping something will stick. The problem with that is when you start attacking lawyers like in Connie's case, that makes a good lawyer never want to take another capital case, because they know it's regardless of what they do or say or do, it's like, damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Well, you know Connie. Did this roll off Connie's back like water?
And then the second, well, it still hurts you when you hear all this stuff on the news every day. You're ineffective. It makes you feel badly. And the next thing it does, that's the theory on throwing everything at the wall and hoping something that sticks, is someday you're going to have a credible argument that's going to listen to you. They thought you'd been an idiot in times past, and they're not going to listen to you. And then there's the other group. What you could have done in this case, rather than trying to attack Connie, I think the logical thing to do is try to attack the constitutionality of the statute, because I think they're way, way in trouble trying to say Connie was ineffective. You could have done some work on the constitutionality of the statute, how it's unfair. This guy had abandonment issues. Mike and I talked about that a lot. Develop that better, because try to explain that better to a jury. And you can attack the constitutionality.
But you could have done the best job in the world. It may not have worked.
Exactly right. It's the old phrase Darrell Royal said, you dance with who brung you. You can be the best plastic surgeon in the world, but you cannot make Sophie Lauren out of hamburger meat. It's real simple.
Okay. Jim's...
Look, this woman had fled him.
Okay. Okay,
this woman left him and ran home to her family, I believe because she was afraid of him.
Sure.
He called her relentlessly. He threatened her. He had shot the tires out of her car, kidnapped her, did all this crazy stuff, because demanding that she come back to him, he was using everything he could do to put fear in her to come back to him. That whole family knew that he was going to come and try to kill her. She took out a protective order, and to claim self-defense, the brother was trying to protect his sister.
Yeah, well, we've ironed that feel. I mean, the jury did what the jury did, and that's the way that happens. We've been joined by some distance by Dale Bash. And Dale, are you there? He's gone. Okay, let's punch him back up again. Dale is an attorney in Arizona, and he was the attorney in the case that represented the guy that was executed over there that took over 2 hours to die. And another factor in this case, and every case for the foreseeable future, as far as I can tell, is the chemistry of
execution. Right, that's going to be an issue until the Supreme Court resolves.
And that is the issue that we have asked Mr. Bash to join us to talk.
My problem with that, what's your alternative? You going to shoot him, or what's your alternative?
Well, I mean, there was at least one of the judges said that, you know, trying to use lethal injection is actually prettying up an ugly procedure.
Exactly.
And let's. The judge thought it would be a good idea that we go back to something that was uglier. Mr. Bache.
I think you should use heroin. Be good.
Mr. Bache, are you there? Dale?
How are you, Roy?
I am fine. You're joining us from where?
Phoenix, Arizona.
And you practice law there?
I'm an assistant federal public defender, and I'm in the capital habeas unit. The lawyers and staff in this unit represent people on death row.
And one of your clients are the people whose cases you were working. I don't know if you can call them clients from your position, but was a horrible story.
Yes, the execution of Joe Wood in late July. The state of Arizona decided to experiment and use a two-drug cocktail made up of midazolam and hydromorphone, and the execution did not go well. It took Mr. Wood almost 2 hours to die.
And what does a lawyer do in that kind of situation?
Well, I was one of the witnesses, and after about 12 minutes, Mr. Wood gasped, he gulped, and then he started breathing. And all of the witnesses were sitting there just watching him. And at some point, I gave a note to one of the other lawyers who was also witnessing, telling her to call my office to tell the office that certain things were happening and the office would know what to do.
Had y'all prepared for this?
Well, prior to Mr. Wood's execution, we asked the state of Arizona for information about the drugs that were being used. We pointed out that this combination had only been used one time before, and that was in Ohio in January of this year, and things did not go well during the McGuire execution. So we weren't expecting it, but we were aware that something could go wrong.
And things have digressed or gone downhill since the Ohio incident. And is there any assurance that what's happening in Huntsville today is going any differently?
We don't know. And we don't know because the state of Texas is not transparent about information concerning the drugs that are used, the source of the drugs, the quality of the drugs. And that's one of the problems that exists in Texas and other states right now, is that executions are being carried out in secret.
And do you anticipate any relief from the appellate courts on this matter? Is everybody cooperating in the cover-ups?
Well, the lawyers in Ohio and Oklahoma and the lawyers in my office all took these issues to the courts. I know the lawyers in Texas went to the federal court and the Fifth Circuit and the U.S. Supreme Court. The courts of appeals seem to be reluctant to touch this issue, but I do think that at some point in time, the U.S. Supreme Court will take one of these cases and hopefully will take a good hard look at these questions that are being raised.
I was lecturing at law school last night, and there are a lot of things in the law that bless your lawyer's heart, because you kind of live behind the curtain, that laypersons and law students are going to have to learn on their own, and that is there's a whole lot of mendacity and a whole lot of secrecy going on in the court system. That's the normal operating environment for people who are professionals in the trade. But to the rest of us, it looks rather weird. We can't see the justification for hiding the information about these chemicals. Lawyers like yourself are in a real struggle to pull the cover off of that.
Well, and that's, I mean, you make a good point. The government interest here is to its citizens and to be transparent how it conducts the people's business. It should not be shielding a company that operates in the free marketplace. Keeping all this information secret, I think, discourages debate about lethal injection and the death penalty. We saw in Arizona after the Joe Wood execution that there was a lot of discussion about lethal injection as a method and the death penalty in general.
Well, Mr. Bish, I appreciate your being on the show and explaining that to us, and I doubly want to express my appreciation for the work you're doing there on behalf of folks that might not have a voice if you were not there to assist them. And it's nice to deal with professionals like you. Now, this issue is going to continue. It's not a quick fix to this.
That's correct. This issue will be raised in the courts in future cases. Here in Arizona, we have a lawsuit pending that I think will go on for some time. We intend to conduct a discovery to try and find out what happened during the Wood execution. There's a similar lawsuit pending in Oklahoma,
yeah,
where a group of prisoners have sued the Department of Corrections, and hopefully there will be some answers there.
Do not be surprised if Elizabeth calls you again, because they do a lot of killing in Texas, and every time they do, we go on the air in real time to report it.
Well, I'm sorry that your show airs so often.
You're telling me. We've had a long sabbatical over the summer, but they've got a tight schedule. We have another execution next week of a woman this time, and the schedule ahead is booked. Thank you, Mr. Bish. I appreciate Dale Bish. What's the name? You're a federal?
I'm with the Office of the Federal Public Defender in Arizona.
Thank you very much for being on our show.
Thank you, Roy.
Okay, and that was Mr. Bish. Now, Dave Atwood is on the air, so let's get a report from Dave. Dave, where are you?
Well, Ray, we're at a different location than we've ever been before. We're at the corner of Buffalo Speedway and West Holcomb, outside the Catholic Church there, but we're out on the sidewalk. We've got a very good turnout for us, anyway. At least we got about 15 people here today.
They had about 30 people in Huntsville, so it's a night of protest.
Yeah, definitely. So anyway, a good turnout, and we pick locations where there's a tremendous amount of traffic, and this is certainly one. This intersection of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of cars go by, so they all see our banners, they see our signs. And this is a new group from a new group of cars, at least, you know, from the people.
Right, you're getting the medical center going home west, correct?
Right. And anyway, so it's a good turnout, and we've got some new people here today. We have a Catholic priest with us today. We've got a couple of novitiates with us today. We have the regular people who are normally here. A good turnout, and I have not heard what is the status in Huntsville.
The process is in progress.
In progress.
Okay. And in today's reality of the chemistry, we have no idea how long that's going to take. We should be hearing from Pat after a while, but we don't know what after a while entails.
Okay. Well, you know, we changed the time of our vigils to start at 6:15 because we knew it was the whole process takes longer now than it used to. So we've tried to adjust to cover the time period a little bit better than before.
Dave, how does one get in touch with your organization?
Go to tcadp.org. TCADP.
Which is the acronym for Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
You got it. That's it. We've got some activities coming up. If they go to that website, they'll see beyond the executions, vigils. We've got a number of things that are coming up. Talks.
You've got a conference. You've got a conference.
Civil Rights Coalition meeting. A conference coming up next weekend. Not this one, but the one after.
And okay.
The death penalty, plus a number of other criminal justice issues, will be as part of that conference. So we'd encourage everybody to come out at the University of Houston next Friday night and Saturday.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate your report. When we hear from Pat, someone will give you a call.
Okay. You take care.
Yes, sir. And so we're back in the room. What else is there? We were into the appeals.
Right. One thing I want to mention before we go to Mike, the problem they have to overcome on this drug issue are two things. Number one, what's your alternative to using a lethal injection? Well, that's been a real problem. What do? You shoot them, cut their heads off? What do? And the next thing, the argument made why they are not transparent. Texas, in fact, said we're going to use one single dose of phenobarbital. So they haven't hidden the drug. The reason they're hiding, the argument for hiding the chemical company that provides the drug, they claim if they reveal that, they could be picketed, protested, someone could get hurt, someone could be injured. Therefore, they want to protect the person that gives it because that's the argument. Made.
So somebody's going to threaten to kill somebody because they're opposed to killing people, right?
That's what it sounds. That's what their argument is. I didn't say it was logical, Ray. I said that's the argument. But the real problem is what's your alternative if you don't have lethal injection?
Sure.
That's a big
problem.
Well,
your alternative is stop killing people.
Well, I understand, but that ain't going to happen recently. You know that.
Not in Texas.
I think one thing is, what could Miss Canada have done to stop this man from killing her? Because he was clearly, this was planned. He had been threatening. He had been, basically, he had been terrorizing her
Susan,
and intimidating her.
I think the jury told us that.
we
don't have to retry the case here.
No,
we just
I'm
have
not
to explain what
the
happened.
Case. I'm just saying, okay, obviously, maybe as a man, you don't really think it's that.
No, I do think it's that serious because
we've got
going on right now in the sports world sensational stories, which are outraging us. But the purpose of Execution Watch is to tell what happened, not become advocates for one side or the other.
But if she had, the only thing I think she could have done was killed him first.
That's a good possibility.
Okay.
Make a note of that, and if that arrives in your life, go ahead and do that, and we'll see how it does.
To arm all women, I guess.
Yeah. Okay.
Michael's
going
to talk about
first.
The witness part of it, too.
Okay, Michael, get closer to that microphone.
Thank you very much. There were some allegations made against Mr. Williams that he was inefficient as an attorney because he didn't call witnesses. I want to tell you this is a very difficult position as an attorney because your client wants to call witnesses. They want to call all their family and all their friends to tell the world what a wonderful person they are. The problem is the lawyer's got to decide whether or not that is relevant. In this case, there was many witnesses. He hired an investigator.
We had a big family. We got a big family outside the Baltimore.
But he hired an investigator. He interviewed the witnesses. Of the witnesses he interviewed, three of them he designated that he might use a trial. The others he didn't designate. When the criticism of him as a lawyer came, there was a two-pronged criticism. The people who talked to the lawyer were upset because they weren't used. What makes you think he wants to use you? Maybe they said something or did something that he thought they were not usable, so he didn't use them. That's his decision to make.
Sure.
In fact, the appellate court laid it out very well. They laid out more of a legal framework. What they said was the witness were upset because they were not allowed to say what they wanted to say. But the attorney contacted him. They didn't think, they did not think he told them what to say. He can't do those things.
No.
What the preliminary appellate court said was very simple. Is that the issue in this case is a continuing threat. The second issue is emotional and mental state at the time of the incident that impaired his ability to rationally handle the situation. And the third thing are the events leading up to his arrival at the girlfriend's house. What the court said is none of these witnesses had any evidence to that. They weren't there. They didn't see anything. They had no evidence for it. So the lawyer not using it...
Well, even if the lawyer put them on the witness stand, then the prosecutor is going to get an opportunity to cross-examine them.
Which gets to the next three.
And where is that going?
Which gets to the next three. The ones that he said he was going to use, he did not use. And the appellate court said it was a strategic decision based upon, I'm assuming what you said, they could have hurt him more than helped him. The problem is this. If you don't investigate, you're inefficient. If you investigate and don't find anything that you can use, you're inefficient. What do you do?
Well, as Jim explained, whenever you're the writ law, you just kind of throw everything at the wall and go for it. And I don't know why someone like Connie Williams is an outstanding lawyer.
Absolutely.
Outstanding lawyer. I don't know why his ego's so tender that if a writ lawyer comes along and does exactly what he did, the best they could under difficult circumstances, I don't know how that would bruise his ego. I calling Walter Boyd an inefficient counsel that's easy. His mother did that the day he was born. But in a real trial situation where your duty is to try to save someone's life, and you could paint anybody any color you want them for the purposes of that case, and you've got a right to do so. Connie, in his position, looked at all of the evidence that he had, and he cherry-picked what he thought might make a difference. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong at all, because the problem people keep forgetting when you put a witness on the stand, there's that little phrase, you open the door for new evidence.
Right.
Because people tend to overstate their point, and they'll open the door to get more bad stuff in, and you end up doing more harm than good.
Right, and when they they think they're the advocate, right. They think they're the lawyer,
exactly.
And God only knows where that hell's going.
Because we see this every week at our appellate updates.
Sure.
A witness will open up the door just getting horrible evidence for the state, and you got to be real careful about that. Plus, there's no way in the world, truthfully, they should have, in my opinion, only you can talk about is a horrible abandonment he suffers as a child. You cannot justify his conduct.
No.
And the trouble is so many family members want to justify his conduct, and that's going to go over like a lead balloon.
Yeah, the jury's not
going to. I'm not going to buy that.
There's nothing in the jury's experience that identifies with
it. Michael talked about that, the abandonment issue. He does a lot of divorce cases and family law cases, and he knows about
that. I could feel for a child in that scenario.
Sure.
But me feeling for the child doesn't excuse the end result that happened years later. The part of me that bothers me sometimes is we seem to have mental health for people if they're educated. But when people are not educated and have no money, we leave them alone and these kind of things happen. Everybody sometimes needs counseling.
One thing is obvious. Willie Trotty was compulsive. He was driven by, for whatever reason, his childhood, his abandonment, whatever reason, his want for love, all this law about a crime of passion, which has come up in this, where would that fit in this case?
Let me address that. Okay, I'm involved right now in a very similar case. I've got a 20-year marriage where the woman was leaving.
But Michael, the question is, where does the crime of passion fit in a criminal case? I can tell you where it fits. Crime of passion is as mitigation issue submitted a punishment hearing.
In other words, you come home and your wife, who you thought was loyal, is screwing with the postman.
Right. Here's what it says. The law is real, real clear. The so-called passion is called immediate passion. You've got to have some event that would enrage any normal human being. And while you're under the heat of that passion, not thinking clearly, you kill somebody. That is an issue submitted to punishment, but only in regular murder cases. It's not available for a capital case. And that's been one of my complaints about the capital murder case, because it's a mitigation issue for regular murder. It is not a mitigating issue for capital murder cases. Because the way it works in a normal murder case, they put on evidence about his you know, about him getting upset. But remember, it's two things. It's got to be, number one, something that's immediate. He does immediately, somebody does something immediately to him that would enrage any normal person.
I believe we have kills. I believe we have a report from Huntsville. Pat, are you there?
Oh, I don't have one. Maybe you should... Hello?
Hello, Pat. What's going on?
The witnesses have just walked out. The execution is over.
Well, that is at 6:40, and so this did not take much longer than a regular time. I think that's good news for Mr. Trotty. He didn't have to lay there and suffer for 2 hours like they did in Arizona, or for more than that, like they did in Oklahoma. But, Pat, while I've got you on the air, how can people get in touch with your organization?
You can go on Facebook under Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. You can email us at abolitionmovement@hotmail.com, or the website is abolitionmovement.org.
I appreciate it. When's your next meeting?
Our next meeting is the first Tuesday of every month at the Shape Center. We will be back here next Wednesday. Because of the execution of Lisa Coleman out of Tarrant County.
Lisa is another scheduled execution. Elizabeth reached out to interview Lisa for Execution Watch and received a report back that Lisa had informed public information that she didn't want to do any media interviews under any circumstances.
Well, that's usually par for the women. They're much more isolated than the men are. And they kind of stick to themselves. It's very hard on the women. I think there's only, what, 7 of them left? Maybe 8 of them.
Pat,
well, I have you on the line, Ray. Once again, we want to give a shout-out to the guys on the row. Our deepest sympathies for losing your friend, T-Rock. I especially want to give a shout-out to the people on Death Watch. And we'll see you again next Wednesday, unfortunately.
Okay, Pat, we appreciate the work that you and the organization do, and thank you very much for bringing us the bad news.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, so the witnesses have come out and crossed the road from whence the whole process begins, and when that happens, that means Willie Trotty is dead, and the state of Texas has just killed him. And normally, if we had interviewed Willie for the show, we would be playing an interview with him at this time, and the whole thing would be videotaped for television. But that's not going to happen in this show because we were not able to do that, and it's not going to happen in the next show because our requests have been turned down. But you wanted to continue.
I have seen this situation without criminal prosecutions, and the part that I just want to say is a lot of men do not accept rejection.
When, well, you know, the old axiom is hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. Well, apparently that not only applies equally well to men, it may in our experience here be more frequently applied to men. Because this is not the first romance homicide we have dealt with on the Execution Watch.
And what I'm getting to is one of the things I see is that a man accepts his own faults if he causes a breakup of a marriage. But in my experience, when a man doesn't do anything wrong and the wife leaves him, he sometimes gets like this because he doesn't understand why it happened.
Yeah, but I don't know if that's true. Willie,
I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
I'm saying that's what I see. They can't accept it because in their world, they're not rejected. They did nothing
wrong. I think probably Willie's situation is Willie was wrestling with demons left over from his abandonment. And those are not minor things. I think that we as a society do not spend as much time thinking about what we do to one another. It's all about me, 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 me. It's kind of like drug addicts. You know, one of the things about being in recovery for 55 years, I know a lot of ex-drunks and drug addicts. And as long as they're drunk, it's about them and their liquor or them and their drugs. And they don't get out of that and start thinking about other people until they find some level of sobriety. And then they have an axiom that life is service and service is its own reward. And when you get to the point where you're concerned, or if equally or if not more concerned, about what you are doing to the people around you, that changes your behavior significantly. And I know you guys on the road were thinking, some of you are re-strategizing. You just heard Jim say that crime of passion doesn't work in a capital case. And I know some of those boys are putting banks on that.
Well, and like I say, it's one thing, this is a good argument. Let me tell you what this is, Ray. This is an excellent argument. This case is an excellent argument for having some type of professional feedback before you even seek the death penalty. For example, we should be, in my opinion, should have a screening group made up of some psychiatrists and some professionals, even decide whether the death penalty is going to be sought. There's also arguments made of having a professional jury who knows how to handle this. Because the problem with something like Michael is talking about, you don't fix that. You can't go back and refix a feeling of abandonment, and there's always that danger he'd get dumped by another girl and shoot that one.
Well,
so
what,
it cuts two ways.
Might mental health courts be right. Some mitigation?
There should be something. There should be some screening, in my opinion, and not a grand jury, because a grand jury is a joke. He's once said they'd indict a ham sandwich.
They did.
And they will. And there should be some type of screening by professional for even seek the death penalty, understands this. And there's also been an argument for professional juries on handling death penalty cases.
Now, how do you think you could get Chuck Rosenthal and Henry Wade to go for that?
Well, both of them were, thank God, Henry Wade's dead and Chuck Rosenthal's on
may
the road
as well
in
be.
Oblivion. I hope he stays there. As somebody said, when he dies only with two people at the funeral because the trash can ain't got but two handles. So I don't think there's a problem with him. But it's going to be hard to get that thing sold in this state because we have a serious, serious redneck problem.
We do. I mean, every trial's like every meeting of the legislature. It's
right.
A rednecking contest.
Jack, you going to join this or are you going to abandon us?
Jack, what you got?
Oh. I've got. I'm going to discuss the Brady issue here, and this is, you know, again, what Williams did was he really threw the kitchen sink at this. Every last possible thing, the appellate attorneys just throwing the kitchen sink at
sure.
it. Every last possible thing.
Do you think you would have done any difference if that had been your duty?
No, no. But, I mean, they brought up this Brady issue, okay? Brady is based upon a case called Brady v. Maryland. Anyways, the idea is that if a state has anything that is exculpatory, meaning it helps the defense, they need to surrender it and give it to the defense. I mean, and that makes good sense because, you know, in any kind of a criminal investigation, here's the power of the state. They have all these paid police officers, detectives, everybody in the world, and they're out investigating. And if they have something that tends to show that the defendant is innocent, they in all fairness they ought to surrender it. And Brady v. Maryland says that they in fact do the prosecution does in fact have to surrender it. Now, in order to succeed on a Brady violation, there are three things that Trotty had to prove. One, that the prosecution actually suppressed the statements, and by that they actually had to try to hide the ball. If you have an for example, in Harris County we have an open file policy. If you have some information and it's in the file and defense doesn't go and look at the file and find it, well, that's too bad. That's poo-poo on defense. On the other hand, if the prosecution actually affirmatively tried to hide the evidence, that's a different story. So first Trotty had to prove that prosecution was trying to suppress the evidence by hiding it or something similar. Two, they had to demonstrate that the statements were favorable to Trotty. And then finally, that the statements were material. So put this in shorthand. The prosecution, one, had to hide something, that two, would help Trotty, that three, in a way that mattered. If you know, if there was a receipt for Trotty buying a Coca-Cola, well, that doesn't really help him, does it? On the other hand, if there was a note, to Trotty saying, you know, from somebody saying, oh, you know, I'm gonna kill you. Well, that might be helpful. That might improve, and that might help a self-defense argument. Anyways, it has to be in a way that mattered. And frankly, in there was really nothing that happened here. The probation officer said Barbara probably did mess with Trotty's head a little. All things considered, this really doesn't really help a lot. It doesn't hold a lot of weight. In order for there to be a Brady violation, you have to, you know, there's so many hurdles to overcome.
The probation officer put on by the state?
Well, that was in the file. What happened, the probation officer said at one time that Barbara's probably messing with his head. They criticized Connie for not bringing that out at trial, thinking that. So in fact, one of the real lawyers in California, had the jury known this and had they known they had an ongoing sexual relationship, they would have converted it from death to life. I think she's crazy, but that's what she said. Yeah. And they criticized Connie for not bringing that out during trial.
Okay.
And the appellate courts actually said that, look, the prosecution did, first of all, you failed on point number one on Brady. The prosecution didn't hide anything. As I understand, the prosecutor on the pretrial was Kate Dolan. I've dealt with Kate Dolan. She's a wonderful human being. And, you know, I've worked
with
her.
You have a case coming up against her?
No. I don't currently have anything on. You know, she's not one who plays tricks. She's a nice woman. She plays by the rules. If anything, I would think that Kate is likely to bend over backwards to make sure that there's not even a hint that the prosecution's doing anything.
You know, when you have a capital case and you're talking about a human life online, doesn't everything just kind of sharpen up?
Yes.
Except in Chuck Rosenthal's case.
Right.
Don't even prosecutors.
You can't use Sharp and Rosenthal in the same
sentence. No, that's probably
true. It's an oxymoron,
true.
But go ahead.
But don't even prosecutors try to get it right?
Yeah, I really think they do.
Well, see, here in Ray, they'll give you you can read the entire file to your heart's content. Because that was one of the big issues about hiding this statement. They said there's no evidence the state ever hid it. It was in the file, and Connie read it. And there's no way in the world Connie would have thought that would have helped his case.
Well, he wouldn't have called the probation officer in anyway because of ancillary information that might have come forward.
They had a lot more stuff. He dragged a lot more baggage with
him. That's right. I mean, and all that. Well, I want you to know it's good seeing you guys again coming in here.
Susan may be armed next time.
No. Susan's going to be around. Me and Susan are going to get along. I love her like a sister. I do have to play host every once in a while. It's a macho thing. You do a little research. But Mike just told it up front. He said, hey, I've been missing you guys, and I have too. I'm glad we haven't had any work to do. But I have been missing doing the show. I don't enjoy doing the show, but I enjoy the people with whom I do this show. And we're getting to the point now so that we need to wrap up the show. I don't know about you, and I don't want to overanalyze the evidence that you, the listeners, have heard. You're kind of our jury. You listen to the evidence, and you make up your own mind, and you've got the right to believe who you want to believe and not believe who you don't want to believe. You even got the right to side with Susan against my efforts. That's fine. That's part of the game.
Susan armed every woman, I think.
But the deal I would like to bring out, did you catch the subtle anger in Mr. Bass's voice?
Yes.
He is still hurting from that capital case that he witnessed. And that is going to affect his professional life. I don't care how hard-shelled you lawyers think you are, and Larry Douglas is sitting over there trying to look coy, but the fact of the matter is, I think he's just the most vulnerable one in the room, and there's a lot of vulnerable ones in the room. You can't practice law without the people you deal with and what is happening to them affect everything else. It affects who you are. It affects what you think about your profession. It affects what you think about the world in general. And the amazing thing is that I know people who've handled... Gabe Nahas must have had 2,000 clients at one time or another. I mean, he was taking court-appointed cases in every courtroom in the building and doing his damnedest to do that. But he never stopped feeling for his clients. He didn't callous over that part of his psyche. He never stopped. I remember walking to a courtroom, and Gabe was laid out on the floor demonstrating something, and the judge wasn't paying attention, and he looked up, and Gabe was laying on the floor, and he thought he had had a heart attack when he was trying to make a point to a jury.
I've often said they ought to build a monument to Gabe. He put more people in prison. Half the prosecutors did. They ought to bury him in the walls of Huntsville.
That's why some lawyers, even if they do wrong, don't go to Huntsville,
exactly,
because it's a problem. But I want to thank you, the listeners, the loyal listeners, and you're all over the world. I get emails from people all over the world. What we try to do here is we try to give you a bird's eye view of a horrible incident and the things that led us to this point. And the things that led us to a point include a story, include trials, include decisions made by lawyers and decisions made by appellate lawyers and writ lawyers. And we have to juggle those things in such a way for in one short hour. This is not a memorial to Willie Trotty. This is a memorial to the evils and the weaknesses of the criminal justice system. I am Ray Hill. I am the host of Execution Watch. The music we have provided you have heard tonight from Jim Skelton, Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Michael Gillespie, and Jack Lee from the lawyer team. Willie Trotty is dead. Dale Bache was our interview guest. Our engineer tonight is Roxy. Thank you, Roxy. You did a wonderful job. This is the first time with us, and she did a good job of doing that. The producer, of course, and the magician of the show is Elizabeth Stein. And the music you're hearing is Victoria Panetti. And her brother was on death row when she wrote this song. This is Ray Hill saying thank you for listening.
Lawyers, most don't. State of Texas, killing machine. Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing me?